Hello and welcome to the latest installment of Aspiration Athletics Podcast. I'm your host, Devin Burnison, and today I'm bringing you an exciting episode with guest speaker, Mr. James Ramsey, who is currently developing research and basically leading the forefront of sports performance research that's being presented to us in modern day. In today's podcast, we discuss some principles of training in which many of you haven't been exposed to in terms of the depth of your training practices. So we go over general preparatory phase, which is preparing you for functional training, preparing you for sport-specific and performance training bouts. We also talk about structured training programs, how to structure your training, how to get the most out of your training, and what to do. We also discuss training modes. Which training modes should you be involved in, depending on your current life circumstances? What are your goals? Helping you find the training mode that's right for you, depending on your goal. And I want to highlight these key points because we discuss these things in great detail, and the training principles that follow get pretty in depth, and I want all of you to be able to refer to resources outside of this. So if you hear these verbs of GPP and periodization, block training, all of these terms that are going to present themselves that may be foreign to you, I want you to write these things down so that you can look them up later, and it will give you insight on how to optimize your training efficiently to get the results you want. Furthermore, I want to highlight that Mr. James Ramsey comes from a background that is not related to sport performance and athlete development, and that's why I brought him on the show, as I think his coming of age story and really finding himself throughout his own journey is so important for all of our listeners out there who may not have everything put together and what they want to do just yet, and that's okay. I think Mr. James Ramsey is a perfect example of, that ambition and mental fortitude and consistency and ultimately persistence in, finding something that's going to fill his cup and finding his passion. And it took him quite a long time, but he's there now and he's doing great things in the industry. So without further ado, I present to you Mr. James Ramsey.
Doing good. Just doing my PhD up here, studying VO2 kinetics and some high intensity interval training stuff. I'm not collecting any data right now because literally everyone in the lab, Dr. Kowalczyk's Patterson's lab, is graduating.
Oh, okay.
My good friend James is going off to Ottawa for a PhD. The other PhD is graduating, and all the master students are graduating. So I am literally the only one. So they told me the only thing you're going to focus on is learning all the details on all of the equipment. Because we have mass spectrometer and we have near infrared, and we have a lot of
Wow.
we have a
Working
lot of
with some
stuff.
heavy duty equipment then, huh?
I mean. Plus the breath by breath and stuff, and you got to calibrate it with the VO2 max and everything. So they're like, just focus on this because it's your job, your responsibility to teach the incoming master's PhD students how to do all this. So it's like, oh yeah, don't put any pressure on me.
So yeah, that's kind of that's kind of a big responsibility, man. Holy shit. And you just what is it? Not even a year? Maybe a year?
It's my second semester.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah. So it's been a very short amount of time for you there. And to create some context for our listeners, this guy has been all over you guys, and I'm really actually very excited to bring him on the show and to have him be able to provide some insight on some pretty incredible things going on and developing in the aspect of sport performance. So Mr. James Ramsey has a history of studying at the University of Chicago, as well as studying criminology at University of South Florida as well.
We will be. I have like, I think I have 16 different student IDs.
Oh my gosh. Wow. So why don't we start there, James, and talk about kind of where you're coming from and basically everything up until this point, because you're doing some big things right now, and I think it's absolutely incredible. And I'm very humbled to have connections with someone who's working at the top of all of this and being able to publish information that's creating the forefront of what's developing here.
Yeah, thank you. So yeah, I moved around a lot. I mean, like a lot of these universities, I only took like, you know, a couple classes for a semester, then moved. I mean, like I got University of Central Florida student ID, and I was there when the football team was 0-22.
Oh man.
Yeah, I was like, oh great, I leave and you guys are doing amazing.
I know, so right?
Yeah, so I ended up at University of South Florida, and I got a bachelor's degree in criminology, and then I did a volunteer police internship for a day and a half and realized that that was not the career for me. So I ended up at Eastern Michigan University without much of a scientific background. They're like, okay, take a, you know, anatomy, physiology, and advanced physiology with Dr. McGregor, who could possibly be the very most intelligent guy I've ever met in my life.
Then I second that for sure.
Yeah. Then they threw me to the wolves, you know, like in the classes, you know, so I didn't have much of a background at all in science. So yeah, that was, that first couple semesters was pretty brutal, you know, cause everyone's like, oh, you know, we're talking about all this biochemistry stuff. And I'm like, I never had chemistry. So,
wow. Wow, so that was quite the transition for you then, coming from like this criminology, right? This criminology type of background, and then transitioning into something as extreme and new as sport performance. Like, talk to me about that transition. So where did that come in?
So basically, Bay City, Michigan, for approximately like 7 or 8 years, because I spent half my life in Michigan, half my life in Florida. You know, I was always involved with Brazilian jiu-jitsu and grappling and MMA and stuff down in Florida. And then I moved up to Bay City, Michigan in the Tri-Cities, and I ended up, it was former IBF world boxing champion Murray Sutherland. He had a gym, and Bellator fighter John Schultz, he asked me if I wanted to help train athletes. And then we had former USOC Greco-Roman assistant Steve Goss, who is one of Steve Frazier's proteges.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, we were training athletes for 8 years. And, you know, so I was always interested in sports performance, especially after my guy John blew his knee out on Spike TV in competition. So, you know, it's looking back, when a lot of the training we were doing, this is when CrossFit started becoming popular, so on and so forth.
So give me like a year range for our listeners.
I think I was training guys at in New Body probably about 2006 to about 2013. Okay. For my master's degree. And then I actually took extra classes because at EMU they have the sports performance track.
Right.
I don't know if they have it. You know, they got rid of some of the classes. Like for biomechanics, Dr. Scott Rewald, who runs the Olympic Training Center, the winter sports and stuff like that. We had him. You know, we had some other high level people. So I did the sports performance, and then I did the cardiac rehabilitation and stuff like that. So, and then the whole time, so I was in graduate school or working on my master's degree longer than what most people typically would, because I did both tracks, the cardiac rehabilitation and the sports performance, and I did a thesis on the bilateral force deficit. So I was at EMU for quite a while.
Wow, James. So that's, really quite the development story, and I think that this is exactly what, you know, this whole podcast is predicated upon, is really these bigger ideas, the bigger picture, and you really hit it on, you know, hit the nail on the head with that. You're doing awesome things, man, and you came from such, like, you can see each stage you're building up, you know, throughout your resume, and I think that's incredible. So
I know you talked about being on the rehab side of things, cardiac rehab, right? So what about the contrast between cardiac rehab and sport performance? What were some things that you found there?
You're going to do more extreme things with athletes. For example, plyometrics, developing explosive power, so on and so forth. For cardiac rehabilitation, they're not going to have them. They're going to have them work out steady state, so on and so forth. But I really didn't find that interesting. So, I was actually while I was working on my master's, after I defended my thesis, I was like looking around at research and stuff like that. And someone in one of my graduate classes actually did a presentation on high intensity interval training.
Okay, yeah, and that was
And
like a newer idea at the time, right?
I can't remember who it was off the top of my head. They did a presentation on high intensity interval training, with Dr. Belfry, who got his PhD at University of Toronto. I was like, oh, this is pretty interesting stuff. So, I kept reading a lot of, looked at his publications and stuff like that. And then right before I defended my thesis, I contacted him. I was like, my name is James Ramsey. Here's a copy of my transcript, so on and so forth. And, just went from there, came up, me and my wife came up to London, did the interview, interviewed with everybody at the lab, and here I am.
Wow. But I mean, you make it sound like it was this flawless transition, and that's what I love about you, James. You're a very humble guy, and I think that's exactly what's gotten you to this place so far, is that you are humble, and at the same time you just kick ass at life, man. I remember, I mean, in the small time that we've known each other in the grand scheme of things here, because you've been on this journey for quite some time, but I got to experience a small piece of that at Eastern. And this was when you were doing your unilateral versus bilateral research, right?
So yeah, it's funny because I saw on YouTube Michael Boyle, he's a high level coach. He had a video, the death of back squatting, blah blah blah, and I was like, yeah, well, bilateral deficit. So I thought it'd be interesting. So I did my master's research on that. Actually, there was a at the same time I was doing my research, there was a lot of other researchers that were doing research on it as well. So basically, is what it all boils down to: if you train with both legs at a time, you're going to be stronger with both legs at a time. You're going to be able to produce more power with both legs at a time, relatively speaking. And if you train with one leg at a time, you're going to be stronger with one leg, at a time, relatively speaking, be able to generate more power, so on and so forth.
Okay.
So now I thought it was interesting. So Cal Diaz, the triphasic, it's interesting because when he peaks his athletes, he uses one leg at a time. So,
Interesting.
during the general prep phase, he'll have a bilateral squat, but for peaking, he'll have them with unilateral squat. So
Now,
I've been advising,
yeah,
yeah, go ahead.
and that's just the thing, right? Like that obviously goes against the principles of the research that you're finding. So has that caused any disruption or any change of kind of the approach moving forward with some of these
So
coaches?
basically, well, there's a lot of coaches that don't want to listen to research, I mean,
Yes. And that's a topic for a whole nother day as well.
basically is, everyone, there's a lot of people that think that, know-it-alls, it's like, oh, 5-3-1, or this particular method, so I keep a pretty open mind. So, like Cal Diaz is, I mean, he's produced 540 Division I All-Americans
Wow.
in the short, relatively short period of time that he's been at University of Minnesota. So, I came across his stuff and I was reading how he peaks his athletes. There's actually a podcast online where he was talking about how he peaks athletes with one leg at a time.
Okay.
If you think about it, when you run or you cut, you know, running back when they explosively cut or change direction, or a fighter, you know, it's with one leg at a time.
Yeah, that makes sense.
You step with one leg. You know, I think I'm the first person to peak the upper body with, you know, one arm at a time. I haven't seen anyone else do that. So,
oh wow, so you kind of pioneered that research then, in a sense.
Yeah, it's it's more anecdotal evidence, but with a lot of these professional fighters and stuff like that that I've been, you know, advising since like 2012, because I've made so many friends. And you know, like my buddy Carl Deaton just won down at America Top Team, just won a world title in Georgia, you know, and I'm always, there's like a bunch of guys that I used to train, and I'm always giving them advice and stuff like that. So, you know, it's like, you know, for general prep, you know, I like that EDT training, density training, you know, like 60% one rep max, you know, you do like one front squat, one pull up. Right. You know, immediately forth, you know, it's very popular. I can't remember the guy who came up with it. So that's like typically what I do. I'll have them in the GPP phase, you know, both limbs at a time.
Yeah. And for our listeners out there that don't know what GPP is, can you extrapolate a bit?
Yeah. Just general preparatory phase. You know, you divide everything into phases with periodization. Like Dr. Stone has a great, YouTube video, but I mean, periodization for each sport is different, you know, like MMA and professional fighting, you know, they don't have a lot of time to prepare. So, you know, it's, I actually started talking with the guy who runs the UFC gym, the PhD, Roman, I can't say his name, you know, he's a Russian, right. He's had a PhD for like 18 years. He sent me what, you know, he was like advertising on LinkedIn. Hey, you know, UFC gym, just, you know, we just did a little publication thingy, and you know, and he Dropboxed it to me. They actually use a linear periodization, you know, and then for the specific fight camp, you know, to prep them specifically for a fight, then they switch to a daily undulating periodization 3 days a week. So
yes, and I talk about this a lot in previous episodes in the podcast, this idea of periodization and block training. For our listeners, I know you can go into so much more detail and into really the science of it all. Explain why this is in the realm of sport performance and optimization for athletes.
Well, basically, is this, you know, I can use a lot of fancy definitions and stuff like that. Just breaking everything down into layman's terms, like I tell my athletes, you can't train heavy and you cannot train at high intensities all the time. Your body's going to break down. Right. Like you remember when you first met me, I was doing CrossFit all the time and I was like really, really skinny. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I got into cluster training and then you saw me, you know, pulling close to 500 pounds on a deadlift.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Yeah. Because I wasn't using periodization. I wasn't organizing my training. You know, you can't just go to the gym and do random things,
right,
you know, like
right.
Within the block. Okay. For this month, I'm going to focus on low intensity interval training and hypertrophy. So there's a really good free article online, really good free PDF by the National Strength and Conditioning Association, Periodization for MMA. And this is important because it gives you a fundamental understanding of opposing physiological adaptations. So basically you're training your body in a specific manner where you're not fighting yourself. You're not taking two steps forward and one and a half steps back.
Right,
so,
which seems to be the large issue in most of athletes and what is known to sport performance up until this point.
Right, exactly. You know, for example, hypertrophy, you know, you want to match that with low intensity interval training. You know, because hypertrophy, the adaptations are peripheral to the body.
Yep.
And we'll leave it at that. While low intensity interval training, the adaptations occur central to the body. And then with strength power adaptations, you want to pair those with high intensity interval training, because strength power is primarily central neurological, and peripheral adaptations or HIIT, high-intensity interval training adaptations are primarily peripheral, so you're not fighting yourself.
Okay.
But you can't train these modalities. You can't train high-intensity all the time, because look at me. I was, like, walking around at, like, 165 when I first got to EMU.
Yep.
And then when I graduated, I was about 195, and now I'm about 215. I should be 210, but my wife became a really good cook, so...
Garnett cooking.
No eight pack pictures on Facebook for a while. So I'm 215. That should be like 210, you know? So the point is, you have to organize your training in segments. Okay. For this period of time, I'm going to focus on this, because your body is going to adapt specifically in the manner of which you're training, you know? Yep. I mean, if you start training in 10 different modalities, your body's, you know, not going to be able to effectively adapt.
Oh, but James, don't you know that's muscle confusion?
Oh, God. Yeah, confuse me.
Right. And this is exactly what I want to point out to all of the listeners out there, is that, you know, all of the science and research coming out is only showing, and I mean, you can shed insight on this clearly, is only showing that we're overthinking this whole thing, you know, and all of these fallacies and all of these supplemental routines and all of these crazy unorthodox methods, when really it just comes down, in essence, what you just said. In order to get good at what you're doing, you have to do, you know, continuously train in that modality, right? And structure your training into blocks that are accomplishing certain goals within it.
Right, exactly. And within those blocks, then you can use slight variation, yes, you know, within the reps. Exactly. Yeah.
Which is where the undulating portion comes in.
Yeah, exactly. That's how Cal Diaz does it. You know, it's like, for example, within a week, if he has them lifting like his 6-day template, you know, 3 upper body, 3 lower body, you know, for example, Monday, Wednesday, Friday is heavy squat, you know, is squats,
right?
You know, like Monday would be medium weight, we'll say. Wednesday will be heavy, and then Friday will be light. You know, it's that, you know.
And that's also another thing I want to point out as well, is like, there's no right or wrong answer to that block type of training orientation. Depending on, and here's the thing, it's dependent upon the individual, and it's dependent upon the goal, right?
And yeah, that's the key thing. Everybody recovers differently.
Correct.
You know, like one of the, yeah, you know, it's, like Poliquin's principles, the guy who just passed last year, longtime strength coach, first guy to ever publish about using DUP periodization, daily undulating periodization. He talks about, you know, the bell curve. 68% of everybody's going to adapt to this.
Yep.
Some people, and that other 34%, you know, you cut that in half and they're on the other side.
Yeah.
You know, for example, some people will need more, some people will need less. I mean, everybody's, their ability to tolerate stress.
Yep.
Yeah.
And these generalizations made in the sports performance realm lie in that 64% that we're referring to.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's like, if you're not making progress, you know, you got to look at, you know, your training, your diet, are you getting sleep, so on and so forth.
And that's where it comes in too, like, understanding that, especially if you're a bodybuilder or sport performance or whatever your respected individual endeavor is at the time, like, you're going to have to manipulate not only your training modalities to match, but your nutrition. Like, it comes down to this holistic conglomerate of variables that ultimately produce the outcome.
Right. It's like, you know, the difference between bodybuilding and sports performance. Like, sports performance, you know, it's like nobody's really doing bicep curls a little bit, you know, except for during a hypertrophy phase. But like Dr. Israetel, you know, who I respect, you know, I got his PhD under the legend Dr. Stone, You know, he talks about smaller muscles, such as your biceps, you can train 6 days a week.
Yeah.
But bigger muscles like the legs, you might only be able to train those once a week.
Right, right.
You know, it's like, you know, it's like a boxer really isn't going to be doing a whole, you know, bicep curl 6 days a week because he's getting enough, you know,
but
them biceps are
getting. But it's also dependent, too, upon the goal at hand, you know, as a result of your end training block.
Yeah, exactly. You know,
so if it is a you know, a power phase, so to speak, you can train, or you would have to follow kind of that rule of training legs once a week, or could follow that principle rather, right?
Yeah, well, it comes down also it comes down to volume, and you can divide it up and so on and so forth. But I think it was funny. I don't know if you saw that podcast with Dave Tate where he's talking about them people that are squatting 85% 5 days a week.
Oh my gosh, I know that overload.
Oh yeah, he's like, who the F wants to squat 5 days a week at 85%? You know, it's like,
talk about joint impingement, huh?
Yeah, you know, I mean, if you're gonna squat 3 days a week, you better be using DUP. You know,
yeah, and if you are using depth at 85%, you know damn sure it ain't good for you. And I mean, at that frequency.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, some people, this is a whole other problem with the Instagram phenomenon is outliers. There are some people that can squat heavy 3 times a week. I'm not one of them.
Right, right. And neither is most everyone else. Those are the ones that you said are either on one side or the other of the bell curve, you know, and those are the extreme cases. And that's mostly coming from, you know, a place where I was lost in my training when I first started, you know, and especially coming from a background where I was a decorated wrestler and I wasn't doing all of these training modalities to optimize my performance. And it's like seeing all of those variables put together really do create the holistic outcome of a well-performing athlete, an exceptional athlete. It's like the principle, I mean, you're privy to MMA. So it's like the principle of, when UFC was first created, the Ultimate Fighter, they thought it was which martial art was going to be the best, right? They competed to find out, and then come find out it was really encompassing all of the arts. That's how you became the best fighter.
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's like my buddy Bobby Hughes. He's just got his third-degree black belt from the legend Hop Samora. You know, he teaches out of Tampa and stuff like that. It's like we started this it was funny because we would train with the judo club at University of South Florida in like 1997. And, you know, back then everybody was like, you know, me and Bob were talking about this. We remember everyone's like, oh, I do karate, it's the best. Oh, I do judo, it's the best. Oh, I do wrestling, it's the best. Oh, I do jiu-jitsu, you know. But, you know, it, you know, you have to have, you know, it's nutrition, it's sleep. You know, and also something else that I always tell people, you want to think prehab, not rehab. It's, you know, prehabilitation, you know.
Correct, correct. And that's exactly something, too, I want to point out. And that's been a huge part of my success and development in my performance lifting and my Olympic lifting and everything I've kind of oriented my training around now is being educated and open-minded to understanding the benefits of prehab type training and being disciplined enough to understand and to go through it. Now, here's where most people get confused. Well, not even confused. Here's where most people let their ego take over is they don't take the time to go into the gym and spend, you know, have a actual 2-hour workout or even an hour, but spend those times necessary to do prehab work and to add it into either, you know, the beginning or end of your program to assure that you're building up supporting and deficient muscle groups, you know, because ultimately if there's an energy leak, right, James, if there's an energy leak in that mechanic of the lift, you're ultimately overusing one muscle group or another. Am I wrong?
Yeah, it's like how many nobody misses bicep day, yeah. But who needs to get the gym training their neck?
Right.
Nobody misses biceps. You know, you get these biclopses that they only train their biceps 6 days a week, and they got legs like a little like a 5 year old. But they got these. Yeah, biclops. You know, I call them biclopses. You know. Yeah, it's sad. There's so much misinformation. It's like the other day at the gym, I saw this guy with his, hypoxic mask, which doesn't simulate hypoxia, doing bicep curls with UFC gloves on, you know, and I'm like, should I say something?
And that's the problem is, like, this is why I want to shift the tide, though, James, and you see it too, and this is what's plagued the Gen Pop, so to speak, that I've had to deal with. And this is what's opened my eyes to it is, you know, I was in the sport performance realm at Eastern, and I've shifted into my full-time job right now as a personal trainer, but more on the prehab and geriatric demographic. And I'm realizing the more I work with Gen Pop and even some of these other special populations, they are so negligent to the implications of poor training habits. I mean, they're even negligent to the poor habits of just daily stressors of life and how they weigh on your physiology.
Oh, exactly. Like Dr. Mann, you know, one of the legends of sports performance. And I saw a video of him online. I can't remember if he was presenting at the National Strength and Conditioning Association. He's like, stress is stress.
Right.
You know, I mean, whether it's stress of final exams or stress of training too hard. And I think another important concept I don't think people realize is like auto-regulation. Like sometimes if you're not feeling good, it's okay to dial things back. Mm-hmm. And it also might be indicative that you might need a deload. You know, it's like myself, if I don't deload every third or fourth week, I crash and burn. You know, some athletes go 2 months without deloading, you know.
Longer. Let's talk about those biclopses that literally are like you're talking about, you know, it's chest and bi day and they're 85-90% 3-5 times a week.
I know. And the problem is a lot of times, like, you know, I saw someone, they were doing deadlifts, but they would bend their arms as they would come up. So they were actually like, you know, those jerking on their biceps. Yeah. And so, yep. They were deadlifting. I was like, hi there. My name is James. I'm in the PhD program here. You want to have your arms, you know, your arms straight. You want to make it skeletal, not muscular, or else you're going to tear your bicep and stuff like that. And it's sad because you try telling them and they don't want to listen. Oh, you know, my friend does it like this and he has big biceps.
Oh, my goodness. That's another thing, too. Like, okay, let us both try to shed some light on the negligence here. Just because a person may have a larger frame or bigger muscle surface area, ladies and gentlemen, does not make them healthy, does not make them in shape, does not make them fit, does not make them knowledgeable, to say the least. And that's just being nice and not getting on a tangent about how infuriating it is to deal with individuals who spread all of this misinformation, and they're ultimately attributing to the plague of all of the confusion within this industry. It reminds me of supplements.
Oh yeah, it's like, I don't know if you found out, but did you see that 2017 HMB study where the guy got fired from University of Tampa for making up the data?
Oh my gosh. I think I did read something about it. It may have been something you posted. Did you post it?
Yeah, something I posted. Yeah. So this, you know, basically this stuff, it was pretty funny because for those that don't know, Stuart Phillips is like, I don't know. He has like 400 publications. I mean, you know, he taught at Stanford Medical School briefly, did a sabbatical. And it was funny because he replicated this guy's 2017 study, He's like, I can't believe that people think that HMB is some magical supplement when all it is dress down Lucian. And yeah, this guy got fired from University of Tampa. And it was crazy because his study showed that, and Stuart Phillips even wrote hashtag better than steroids. It's like, yeah, you're going to take the supplement for 2 months and put on like 16 kilograms of muscle.
Oh,
it's like, what?
Really?
I need to order myself some, you know, but yeah, I mean, it happens, you know?
Yeah. And far too often at that. And that's just the thing too, is much, at this point, as much access to the real info that people have, and maybe people just aren't aware of, I guess, the power they have to look into all of these things. Because honestly, like, nothing special about you or I, and that's what I want people to understand, is, James, like, you came from a criminology background, you know, nothing that was sport related, and now – I mean, you've trained pro athletes. And for those of you that don't understand the depth, people in the UFC, you know, I mean, and it's been the kind of the center of your life after that. But coming from that mode of criminology and that background that was unrelated to sport and physical fitness in general, getting into it now and just understanding that you were open-minded and willing to put in the work of learning, right? Like, especially because it became pertinent towards your health.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah, exactly. You know, it's there's that thing called Google Scholar. And another important thing is,
oh my gosh, thank you.
Yeah, Scholar, you know, it's like this, like that crazy Netflix documentary where the guy, you know, like they're pushing that ketogenic diet. And the guy had, you know, supposedly is a neurologist. And he's like, well, you know, fat is the brain's preferred fuel source. I about choked on my popcorn. I'm like, what? You know, it's like you look up, you type in Harvard Medical School, brain prefers glucose.
I know, and it's shocking to me, James, and this is the problem. Exactly the issue at hand is there's people see it come out on TV, or they see it come out on a freaking Facebook ad or something, and then automatically it's law. And it's just so – we're in such a delicate state in the transition from – things being brick and mortar and things being kind of manually done to digitized and having all this access, where there needs to be some mitigation involved, or I mean, to some extent, right? Some mitigation of information out there. But the problem is, much like anything that involves money, that's where the money's at, is the confusion revolving around this. It gives companies leverage to be able to sell bullshit.
Yeah, exactly. Actually, I just remember now is what I need to do. If that guy really is a neurologist, I need to contact the American Medical Association to get his license pulled. I mean, saying that the brain prefers to run on fat is like saying water is H4O. You know,
right? It's just so counterintuitive, to me, again, it's infuriating. You know, coming from a place of passion where I've predicated my life on this pursuit of knowledge and this pursuit of optimization and this pursuit of ultimately informing those on how to not only get involved from the place that they're at a physical level, but also behaviorally being able to shift their mentality and their perceptions towards this pursuit of a fitness goal, right? Like, because ultimately too, you understand that your perceptions towards exercise are directly correlated with your performance.
Yeah.
I mean, if you don't believe in what you do, if you go into the gym, you walk into the gym with no workout routine or no training program, your chances of performing as well as the guy who has a periodized training block is very little to none.
Yeah. It's like, I think I'm the perfect example. You remember me, how weak and skinny I was.
Exactly. Yeah. And no offense, James, but yeah, I mean, you really, you came a long way, man. And, and this is what I loved about you. And this is exactly why I had to make it a point to get you on this show is, to really have our viewers and listeners understand that you really came from a place where you were not incompetent, but just not fully understanding the principles, and you learned it from the book and applied it to your own practices and trial and error. I mean, you really went through a process of finding what worked for you.
Yeah, exactly. So basically, I think my first initial bump in success was the 5-3-1. Not that it's the best program,
can you reiterate and for our listeners and kind of explain that briefly?
So basically the 5-3-1, the first week, you know, you work up to five, you know, not to a 5 rep max, but pretty close estimate. And then the third week, you know, close to a 3 rep max, and then, you know, the third week a 1 rep max. But what's important was the fourth week you deload. You just, you know, work up to 5 reps at like 50%, 55% 1 RM.
Right.
You know, just so you don't lose the neurological learning. I can't remember if 5-3-1, if it goes up to 50% 1 rep max or 60, you know. But the key thing was I was building, and then dialing it back. Because when you dial things back, you know, you take that week and you just dial things back, go easy. That's when your body makes those, you know, those anatomical adaptations. Like my buddy Rick.
Yep.
Yeah, exactly. Like Rick Buen, who's at EMU, who helps me with my strength and conditioning groups. He was down at Bomarito's down in Pompano Beach. I don't know. They got like 400 or 500 NFL people. You know, NBA athletes with $120 million contracts, and they deload. I mean, these are NFL athletes. These are, you know, this is probably some of the strongest human beings on earth, and they're deloading every 4 weeks. I mean, there's different variations, you know, like Joe Ken, the Carolina's coach, you know, he deloads every 3 weeks. He does a base build, deload, and then performance test. And so, but the point is, you know, there has to come a period of time where you have to dial things back to let your body heal.
Yeah. And I think that's a great principle too. And as much as people want to get into the nitty gritty of a training program, even at an elite level, like you're publishing out there in your research, James, for people that are just looking to optimize their time in the gym, what it comes down to, everyone, is structuring your training. You know, that's a big principle. For one, is finding out what you want to accomplish within a time frame, and then creating blocks of training within it that are accomplishing certain goals that are ultimately going in the overall attribute to successfully completing that task at hand, or that, you know, whatever the case may be. So just understanding that in essence, at its purest form and simplest form, organize your training, organize the way. It's just like creating a business plan. Like I've described before, is like you have this overall 5-year plan of how you want to build this dream company, the end point of a 5-year plan. Now you got to come up with everything, the meat and potatoes in between of how to get there. It's the same thing with your training endeavors.
Right. And you have to have a certified, qualified individual to take you there. It's like, for example, you know, if I'm going to have someone take a look at my transmission in my car or my brakes, I'm not going to go talk to my neurologist, you know, and I'm not going to talk to my mechanic about brain surgery. You know?
Exactly.
I mean, performance coaches, you know, I mean, we specialize in this. This is all we do. You know, I mean, know.
And that's just the thing too, is understanding you guys that you have, and maybe people don't know, right? Like maybe to the extent of their knowledge, and I'm finding this more that I work with Gen Pop, James, is that people really don't understand that there are resources available beyond a personal trainer. And they think that, like, and let me make it clear to all of you, I'm a certified personal trainer, but I will tell you right now that that is the bare minimum to get started by even just taking on and monetizing what is training. So that does not by any means make you a good trainer, for one, and able to produce results that people want. So going in precluding back to what you were saying, qualified individuals, you know, exactly. So, I mean, you don't want to listen to just John, who's got big biceps as a result of PED usage, you know, and then attributing his success to doing fucking hammer curls with a straight bar. It just like, and that's it. It just, it's mind boggling to me. The misinformation and all of the, just the negligence regarding this industry and training modalities in general. How do people not know how to use their own body? It's incredible to me. It's 2019 and people don't understand how to manipulate their body and change it according to how they see fit for their lifestyle.
Yeah, I think the problem is they watch the CrossFit Games and like, well, you got to train till you puke. Well,
yeah, that's true.
That's not a general population thing. I mean, like, there are phases, like, in the realm of, you know, these are completely polar opposites. You know, like, professional fighting, there are times you need to push them, you know, beyond their breaking point, but you don't do that on a daily basis, okay? Or they're going to end up in the hospital with kidney failure, you know? Exactly. I mean, you know, what was that? Remember that crazy story? How many years back was it when the Oregon strength coach sent a couple at like three or four? Was it Oregon where three or four of the football players ended up getting hospitalized?
Oh, it was Maryland.
Oh yeah, just
yeah. I mean, that was recent, man. That was just this past year, last year.
Well, it also happened at Iowa.
Oh yeah, true. Yep.
Yeah, it happened in Iowa, and then there was something else. It was Oregon, because I was still working on my master's, where he was having the football players do burpees for an hour straight without something like that. I'm like, first of all, football, it's like 5 seconds. It's ATP PC.
Right, right. Okay, briefly first, and I know me and you can do this all day, but ATP PC, please elaborate on that, please.
It's just explosive burst, 5 seconds.
Right, and the energy systems involved.
Yeah, 5 to 10 seconds, depending on the paper. But what's important is it's short, explosive burst. You know, yeah, in football, a running back might run for an 80-yard touchdown, which might take 15 seconds, but the vast majority of the plays on average, you know, 5 seconds.
Right.
You know, but yeah, this, I don't know what this guy's qualifications were. He was having the football players do burpees for an hour, you know, and then it was Iowa, right, where they had the football players squat 100 reps for time.
And none of that, again, going back to you train what you train in the direction in which the goal you're trying to accomplish. What was that one meme that you posted on your page? Or you, it was something like, you don't have someone run if they're trying to do, I don't know, some sort of joke you posted, but it had me cracking up.
I don't know. The best one that everyone from my graduate school program remembers, it was at EMU and they came in, they were yelling at me because I did a clean and jerk and I dropped the weight and I told them, I goes, listen, I don't tell SEAL Team 6 how to run terrorism counter operations. I don't tell an astronaut how to fly a space shuttle. I don't tell a theoretical physicist how the universe works. Don't tell me how to do a clean and jerk.
I love it, James. That is, I that just made my heart smile. And you know what is funny to me is, you were well within the realm of that knowledge and being able to, back up what you were saying in terms of the form and execution of the lift, because I'm pretty sure I was there when that happened. Christy, right, came up to you.
Yeah, one of them.
Yeah, well, I remember Christy got involved anyway, but I thought, to me, it was just like a win for just the continuity of the survival of progression in this industry, man. I was so happy when that went down. Oh my goodness.
It's like my PhD, you know, I'm studying VO2 kinetics. Likely I'll do something with high intensity interval training or breath hold training, blah, 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 blah. But does that make me a world renowned neurosurgeon? No. Does that make me a nutrition expert? No. I know a lot about nutrition, and I always refer to people to the International Society of Sports Nutrition. You know, I read a lot of their blogs and I read a lot of their publications, but that's not what I do all day. Now, that's right. In my free time. You know, you want specific nutrition advice, go to a registered dietitian, not someone who read something on Google. It's funny. I think the best story is someone got in an argument with me online about the ketogenic diet. I'm like, send me something with some publications. And they're like, here's a blog with publications. I was like, okay, well, I'm going to check these publications out. And these publications had absolutely nothing to do with the ketogenic diet. And I'm like, you know, and I actually, briefly, I was like, look, this video is talking about losing weight to, you know, prevent type 2 diabetes. There's nothing in here. You know, it's
they linked keto to that principle.
Yeah. The references have to be, you know, specific to it. Like if I write a little training program on improving power, you know, and I put references in there on, theoretical physics, what does that theoretical physics have to do with improving explosive power? You know, exactly. Those are references. Do they mean anything? No.
Right. And this is, again, this is why there is so much confusion, is because people aren't take just like the shit on Facebook you're seeing, where it's easily accessible information, and it's not it. That's all it is, information with no grounds to any your background, you know, or any grounding of research backing it.
Yeah, it's like, you know, I think the best example is the flat earth theory.
Oh my gosh. Don't even get us started. Yes. The flat earth theory, basically, sports performance folks and fitness in general is the flat earth theory in a nutshell.
Yeah. It's like, you know, it's like, I love these, like, you get these guys on, I remember, you know, so I got an Instagram. I was playing around. I was looking around on Instagram. There's these guys, obviously they were on PEDs. They were doing full range of motion military presses with 315 pounds for like five reps.
and that's the problem too, is that you're going to have 17, 18 year old kids trying to do 185 and building up to that when their physiology and it can't support it. And their mechanical errors are only damaging their body. So it's just, it's something that, the social media has created just a huge surplus of bad gym habits, you know, and bad training habits. And it's even gotten as bad as James, and I'm sure you can attest and see, is that even professionals are spreading their own training practices that are simply just wrong and mechanically wrong.
Yeah. There's a lot of, actually one of my Facebook friends did a review on Gordon Ryan's to get swole as a grappler. and Gordon Ryan is a world champion BJJ guy. He went from 162 pounds to a shredded 232 pounds in a year and a half. And he's claiming that it's based on his training principles. And someone who I truly respect on my Facebook, he did a review on it, and it was pretty bad.
Oh, but, I can imagine.
Everyone's like, oh my God, he went from 162 pounds skinnies to a shredded 232 pounds. I'm like, well, also, if you talk to a lot of jiu-jitsu guys, they'll talk about when he was hospitalized for phantom illness for a month. So, you know, you do the math.
Yes,
buddy.
Exactly. And that, what was that one study with, who was it? Back in the 70s where he took his participant in the research and put on 30, 40 pounds of muscle mass in, I don't know, it was like a two week or a month study. It was back when, I'm going to have to pull this up and put it in the show notes, folks, because I cannot for the life of me think about that.
Mike Mentzer crap.
The what?
Mike Mentzer bull crap.
I think so. Start explaining, I'll affirm.
Yeah. You only do one set of maximal intensity for that one set, and you know, like one set of squats for 20 reps, and it's like, well,
oh, that's, I mean, another gonna... one. That I can't think of the one that I was thinking, but that is another one too, where it's just BS principles that are only done on certain individuals, for one, who are either on drugs or, I mean, there's just too many variables in place with some of these old research that a lot of these generalizations are based on that no longer apply or were never even validated to begin with.
Oh yeah, exactly. You know, it's like, if it's one study, it should get your attention to go, this is interesting. You know, but we want additional studies to confirm it, you know. So basically, it's kind of like my study, you know. I was expecting everyone, you know, for the leg press to display a bilateral deficit, which simply means that they'd be able to move one leg at a time. You know, like say if your left and right leg, you got 350 and 350, that adds 7. And then, but with both legs, they're only able to press 600. That'd be bilateral deficit. Right. It's a relatively stronger,
yep,
with one leg at a time compared to two. But my study, I had 28 bilateral facilitations and only 2 bilateral deficits.
So that, and went, I was against, like, that went against the principle, right?
Yeah. So I was like, okay, what is going on? Because the pro athletes that I was training, they all, you know, when I would test them, they would display a bilateral deficit. And you remember EMU gym, it's small. You see everyone all the time. So I was like, hey, do you do one leg? How do you squat? Well, I squat with both legs. How do you leg press? Well, I squat with both legs. Okay. Specificity. Like literally no one did one-legged squats. Everyone squatted with both legs at a time. And right. Thankfully, some studies came out, you know, I can't say some of these names, but they came out like 2016, 2017, 2018, and they showed that the manner in which you train, it was only for lower body. There hasn't been any upper body ones yet. The manner in which you train is the manner in which your body's going to adapt. So if you, you know, train with one leg at a time, you're going to be stronger with one leg at a time, be able to produce more force with one leg at a time. So, but, you know, training with one limb at a time, I mean, even if you're a power lifter, it's good because you want to correct muscular imbalances. Because if you, right, you know, your primary, when you're bench pressing, you know, if your right arm is doing 60, 65% of the work, you know, it's going to result in injury because you're overtraining your right arm, you know?
Right, exactly. And that's another thing, too, that people need to understand in terms of, especially, those that are looking into optimizing a program, let's say you do understand training blocks, and let's say you do understand structuralized training, this is where you have the ability to leverage and manipulate your performance by implementing a lot of these principles of undulating modalities, to where you're taking deloads or maybe transition weeks where you're optimizing prehab, or doing undulating days where you have prehab and then
the remainder of your days are predicated on like a 70-60% load, and then going up to, you know, you run that for 2 weeks and then go up to like a strength phase and then an endurance phase, and then just understanding that each of these phases are going to again attribute to that end goal of whatever action you're looking to improve. So what's a good example, James? If it's like, what's a common thing that people are trying to work on in terms of sport performance?
Sports performance, explosive power. Well, strength lays the foundation for the development of power. So, you know, I have them do, you know, it depends, but I'll have, you know, the time is irrelevant for this example. You know, I'll have them do a strength phase because strength lays the foundation for the development of power.
Yep.
You know, and have them specifically work on a power phase, you know, and then after competition, they need to taper, or not taper, but, you know, a transition phase where, hey, these next 2 weeks, just go to the pool, go to the swim, you know, go for a nice steady state jog at the park, not 10 miles, just right. A nice 2-3 mile jog, you know, or rollerblade in, or go play some basketball, something to get the body moving again, you know, to recover, to get that blood, you know, pumping through the body, but not wear yourself down to the ground, you know?
Right.
I mean, you take that 2-3 week transition phase, you're not going to go run 15 miles, first of all. You know, it's like, that's not specific to professional fighting. I mean, that's specific to marathon runners, but, there's just so much. And then outliers, perfect example, the ultra marathon runner who can squat 700 pounds. First of all, I would love to see a WADA test out of that guy. you know what I mean?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, right. Exactly. And that's the thing is people that don't understand the depth of kind of the contrast of why that can't really be the case without performance enhancers is that your body's made up of three different muscle fiber types. Or is it four now, James?
This is
debated too, and this is why I wanted to bring you in, is because there are, depending on where you look, it differs.
It differs. Actually, I thought about doing a postdoctorate in muscle physiology at McGill up in Quebec, so we'll see what happens. But, you know, just to make it simple, you have explosive muscle fibers and you have, you know, endurance muscle fibers. Endurance muscle fibers, you know, type 1 fibers have a lot of mitochondria, a lot of capillary density. You know, those are for like a 15-20 mile run, you know, for as an extreme example. But people with a high proportion of those muscle fibers, you're not going to see them in the gym squatting 400 pounds. In contrast, type 2 explosive fibers, that's like for example, a world-class sprinter, you know, they're, you know, that 10-second sprint, good luck, you ain't going to catch them. But yeah, they're going to, you know, but are they going to be able to squat 405 pretty easy? Probably, because, you know, as long as they're training squats, you know, if they're in there squatting and stuff like that, they're going to be able to move a lot of weight relative to their body, but they're going to struggle with, you know, trying to run a marathon.
Exactly. You know,
specificity.
Specificity, you know? Of training. And that's one of the main points I want to kind of close and end out with, is specificity of training, folks. And that's what it comes down to, is really coming up with a goal in mind of what you're trying to accomplish in your efforts and what you're trying to accomplish throughout a given period of time. And then once you get there, the journey isn't over. You know, it's time to reevaluate and figure out how to optimize it and how to correct for deficiencies along the way.
Yeah. With lots of, with prehab and stuff like that, it's like people don't think about their neck. You know, neck training is so important, you know. Yeah, you know, there's a lot of great YouTube videos where you can, you know, like bands, you know, those rubber resistance bands, you can use those that are made by, you know, people with PhDs in physical therapy. you know?
Right, and that's something I see the most in my geriatric population, and especially working out towards Ann Arbor, where there's a lot of industrial and office buildings where people are operating out of, is that the clientele that I'm getting are so anteriorly pulled, you know, and their anterior tilt from their upper extremities are cut from due to tightness in their trapezius, their upper traps and their mid traps, and then all of its tight musculature in their neck is not only painful, but you think about the type of circulation issues that are that develop there. And especially now consider this, right? I'm going to blow people's minds here. Circulation issues that ultimately attribute to what? Dementia and lack of blood flow and cognitive implications on the brain, correct?
Yeah. You know, there's
vasoconstriction. It really comes down to, like, if you don't have that type of blood flow to your brain, right, and operating off of the right nutrients via glucose, via carbohydrate, like not eating fucking bullshit, you know, I mean, and it's like, we could go on and on, James, but all in all, man, I want to leave it at that today. You know, we're at that hour point and we could go on forever, but, ultimately, James, I want to thank you for being on the podcast, and I want to open up the floor for you to be able to share all of your media platforms and then tell us about some upcoming research or projects you're working on that we can refer to.
So on Facebook, you know, we have Strength and Conditioning for Combat Athletes, me and Rick Buen, who I talked about earlier, we run, sports performance training science. You know, we post actual publications. You know, this isn't something our uncles made up in the backyard one weekend. You know, right. We have strength conditioning by science. The only study I want to talk about in closing is my buddy James in my lab. He did an amazing beet juice study where they actually collected blood samples, and they're going to, you know, we froze everything and we sent it off to England, where they're actually going to do, you know, detailed DNA analysis to see the adaptations of beet juice training.
Beet juice training. Can you elaborate briefly?
So we had, I had two different groups. You know, it was his study. So one group got beet juice, the other group got placebo, and it was double blinded. It was made, you know, so, you know, we don't know who got what, you know, and we had, you know, and James ran them through time trials to exhaustion and other, you know, training modalities and stuff like that. So, you know, that should probably be, you know, the data, the DNA results should, you know, the detailed testing from, I think King's College in England did that. That's where James shipped it off. Cause I remember I was in the lab. He's like, yeah, I got all the frozen samples, putting it on dry ice, and I'm shipping it to England. And he was all excited and stuff like that. So yeah.
Cause you always hear people. That's fascinating.
Yeah. So this isn't just like, okay, you know, they took beet juice or didn't, you know, here's how they performed, but no, there's actually going to be, you know, DNA analysis to see what type of physiological adaptations occurred.
And that's beautiful, because I've already started hearing looming kind of thoughts on this idea of like beet juice in the morning every day, just for kind of optimizing cognitive enhancement, and even in some cases, like you were talking about, certain adaptations as well.
Yeah, so basically, yeah, it helps with training. So basically, someone did a presentation on it in one of my PhD classes, and basically, it works great for general populations. It works great for, like, we'll say, collegiate athletes, high level athletes, but for some reason, as of right now, it doesn't seem like it works for like the world-class Olympic athletes. So, you know, the elite of the elite beet juice for whatever reason doesn't work for them.
Yeah, that's odd too to think about, and that's going to be something that's going to be itching in my mind a bit because that I want to know when you publish that research though. It's your friend?
Yeah, it's my friend James. I can't pronounce his last name. It starts with a V. I mean, it's out of the University of Western Ontario. You know, it's his study. I was just there to watch, observe, and help out whenever I could. Really great guy. He's going to the University of Ottawa, another world-class school to study cancer research and stuff. So I'm very happy for him. Yeah, I should have paid more attention during that presentation, but my presentation was next, so I was sitting there with my laptop preparing. So, yeah.
Yeah, no, and I totally understand that, but I loved having the chance to be able to talk to you and pick your brain a bit, and I certainly want to be able to set up more time with you to be able to sit down and talk more in depth about these principles. But just as a taste for our listeners, they at least have the generalizations, the principles set in place, the foundations that are on the forefront in developing in this endeavor of uncovering and optimizing sport performance and adaptations in the body, and ultimately really pioneering what is going to be the future of fitness and the future of sport performance. Thanks so much, James, for your time, buddy.
Yeah, no problem, bro. Thank you for having me on.
Yeah, no problem. Well, this has been a podcast presented to you by Aspiration Athletics, guys. Please tune in tomorrow for the next episode. We will have more guests, more interesting speakers, and more motivational stories for you guys to eat up. Until then, everybody, aspire to inspire. Have a good one. Thanks so much.